and welcome to Leeds Student Radio. It is 3 minutes past 1 o'clock on Friday, and you're listening now to Lou's Think Tank, the show where we delve into some of the most pressing and controversial topics which are utterly relevant to our generation today. This week is about eating disorders in young people. 1.6 million people in the UK have an eating disorder, and most of them are aged 14 to 25. Today's show will look at how eating disorders are affecting our generation and just how our society is coping or not with the growing number of diagnoses. I'd like to say at this point, you have to be aware that this show contains a variety of first-hand experiences and opinions. Some content may be found extremely upsetting and or triggering. Coming up shortly, I'll be joined by Jess Murrell, or on radio, Tay, whose own slot on LSR is Mental Health Matters, and later also joined by Jess Reed, President of Leeds University Union's Mind Matters Society, to find out about their thoughts on the topic and the services available in our university, respectively. So first, as always, I'd like to begin with a discussion of the definitions surrounding some of the vocabulary and expressions that will crop up in the next hour. The straightforward Google search definition of an eating disorder is any of a range of psychological disorders characterized by abnormal or disturbed eating habits, such as anorexia nervosa. Then the NHS page definition and examples include eating disorders are characterized by an abnormal attitude towards food that causes someone to change their eating habits and behavior. It then goes on to discuss, which will come up later in one of our interviews, the extreme range of eating disorders that perhaps aren't all always brought to light equally, ranging from anorexia to bulimia to binge eating disorder. EDNOS, EDNOS stands for eating disorder not otherwise specified, where a person may show some but not all of the typical signs of a disorder. So Jess, Tay, as we call her, Murrell, hello. Thank you so much for coming on our show today.
No worries. I'm so glad I get the opportunity to talk about this.
I think it's really, that's the emphasis of our show today, really, is that, this is a quote from an interviewee, Hannah, coming up later, if people don't talk about it, it's going to stay in the shadows and nothing's going to change. And I think that, for me, sums up the exact sentiment of what I want the next hour to portray.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how can you talk to your friend about a really serious problem that you're having if they don't even understand it or they aren't aware of it themselves?
Exactly. So Jess, your show on LSR, it's called Mental Health Matters.
Yeah.
Exactly why do you think it was so important to have that slot on our schedule?
It was a combination of things, I think. The vast majority of my year at school had some kind of eating disorder. But
I think that's, again, something we'll touch on, is this seeming huge, almost epidemic-like spreading of diagnoses within a school, and our generation do seem to have a problem with it in a way that no generation before us quite has done. It shocked me to my core. Online recently I've seen a lot of attention drawn towards eating disorders because of Halloween, and that seems sort of a tenuous link. I don't think if the link is necessarily obvious, it certainly wasn't to me, but articles about people using mental health in general as a source for costume ideas, and I mean, it's 2015 now.
Yeah,
why do you think there's still not enough awareness for that to be happening? And I've got a few articles that we'll discuss in more detail later in particular, but how is it still a problem?
I think a big problem is that a lot of people, they're really keen to laugh at stuff, and they're quite frightened of being accused of too uptight, in quote marks, about their sense of humour. So to avoid that, they kind of, and it's probably a confidence thing as well, they kind of just like try to make jokes about really unfunny and shocking topics.
And do you think it's a lack of understanding even of what it is? Do you think they would even try to find it funny if they knew the extent of it?
I think that it's probably a combination of the two. I think that they probably think of it as an easy laugh because they probably do know that it is quite common. And so they kind of think like, oh, you know, I'm going to relate to this person. I'm going to, you know, I think some people even think I'm going to be bringing this out in the open to talk about, but they're doing it in a really inappropriate manner. You know, I know the Halloween costume that you were talking about, that showed a woman in a skeleton costume with a tape measure around her waist. That's not an eating disorder. It's you know, controlling food. It's not being able to go out to social situations. It's anxiety attacks.
Tate, recently one of your shows in particular has been about eating disorders specifically, and it's a slightly different perspective to the some of the interviewees that we have today. And you're podcasting it, is that right?
Yeah, I've podcasted it already. So if you just go onto
Audio Boom,
and LSR, then you can find my
eating disorder interview. Yeah.
One of my best friends, Tom, he talks about his struggle with anorexia, and I think that that was a really interesting perspective to get, because it's a man talking about it, which is even less awareness than
eating
disorders in women.
11% of the 1.6 million eating disorder diagnoses in the UK, 11% are male.
In that show, he doesn't just talk about his own eating disorder, he kind of explores why he thinks there are so many eating disorders in men and why there's such a lack of awareness around it. So it is really interesting.
We're now going to play one of our first interviews. We've divided them up into sections. This interview is from Rachel Thomas, a third year student at Birmingham University. She was diagnosed with anorexia about a decade ago. Please be aware that this interview contains a variety of first-hand experiences and opinions, and this content could well be found upsetting and or triggering. This is an interview with Rachel. Would you like to chat a bit about your story?
Hey, okay. So, yeah, I'm Rachel. I'm an English and drama student at the University of Birmingham, and I've just started my third year. I was diagnosed with anorexia about age 11, but doctors think the problem probably goes back further than that. I spent 6-7 months in inpatient in a boarding hospital in Oxford, and was on a nasogastric tube, which is one of those things that goes up your nose and forces you. And then I had another relapse that I needed to be hospitalised for when I was 13, and was in and out of hospital and in day patients for, it was like 4 months, and then I carried on going for regular checkups for another 2 or 3. I haven't been in hospital again since then, but I've never really been outside of the system. I've had a couple more relapses, but because of the age I am now, I mean, I'm 20 now. I was 16 and 18 when I had my other two relapses, and because of being that age, then the intervention wasn't the same as when I was classified as a child. I am at university now, but I've been in and out of the part, being passed around between doctors and services, and having to talk to various different psychologists, psychiatrists. I'm still not sure I know the difference. And generally being passed around the system for 10 years, I think. Yeah.
So that's part one of our interview with Rachel on her experiences. She's 20 years old and is a third year student at university. From that, I suppose what I'd like to put forward is a question about how it can manifest itself so young, and the aspects of our society that end up provoking that sort of reaction in someone who is in primary school. That's, you know, that's year 5, year 6 age. That's very, very young to already be falling into a mindset that is so detrimental to yourself. What would you say about that, Jess?
I think what's important to remember is that when someone has an eating disorder, their personality is kind of programmed almost to have an eating disorder. You know, patients who develop an eating disorder later on, they still have very similar personalities to someone who's got an eating disorder of 10. You know, they're quite obsessive. This is a generalization. Obviously, not everyone with an eating disorder has this.
No, of course.
But they're perfectionists. They're never satisfied with something, and there might be an emphasis on not feeling good enough in themselves. So I think it is important to remember that just because someone happened to develop it young, that doesn't kind of make them a special case. It just means that they fell into the trap earlier than other people.
So maybe it's a disposition towards it in general, as opposed to certain things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have to remember also the huge kind of genetic factor that comes with eating disorders. The hereditary aspect of it is absolutely staggering.
And now we're going to move on to part two. Again, I will be saying this before each clip. This could be found to be very upsetting and triggering content. This is part two of our discussion with Rachel. Rachel, in terms of recovery, what have been, if any, significant turning points or moments of change? Do you think recovery is a set and definite thing, or is it an ongoing gradual thing?
I think it's definitely an ongoing gradual thing. The weird thing is for me with recovery is that it's not a one-way thing that you just do. I've been like, I've recovered a bit, or I've stabilised a bit, and then I've gone back, and then I've stabilised a bit in another place, and then I've gone back, and then I've gone forwards, and I've gone back. I've never really, as far as I'm aware, I've been better, and I've got to points where, yeah, of course, I was significantly better than I was when I was in hospital, and I'm able to live my life to a better extent and everything, and I might be in more healthy weight and stuff, but in terms of actual recovery and the thought processes and the way I feel about myself, I don't think I've ever actually, I haven't reached recovery, and it's not, I don't know, sometimes it feels like it's something I won't necessarily reach, like it doesn't feel like a real thing because I started struggling so young. I don't remember my life without an eating disorder, so the idea of me, like as a person, like my identity without it, or the thought that I could have a life that it's not a part of, the thought that I might not struggle with it one day, is a really weird concept to try and get my head around.
Do you think it's a very individual thing?
I think there are definitely, I've had friends or people I've met or come across, and there definitely is this thing where it gets to a point where you realise essentially there are two ways out from an eating disorder. You can't live in the kind of quasi state of pleasing your disorder forever. Either you get better and you recover and you choose recovery, and that's an active decision, or you die, basically. There is no other option. And I think that realisation is definitely a key thing, whether it enables you to literally stand there from that moment to be like, right, well, now I'm going to recover. I have to do this. I have to make a change. Or whether you kind of end up like me, where you're like, yeah, I know where I'm going, but I'm not quite sure how to do it, or I'm not fully on that track. But whichever, it's that kind of a realisation. I think there definitely is kind of that kind of pivot point that happens.
And as far as spotting an eating disorder in peers, do you have any advice about that, or any thoughts about observing it in other people?
This is a really tricky one because it is an invisible illness. I mean, of course, like some, if people do experience drastic weight loss or whatever, then it's much easier to identify. The range of eating disorders is extraordinary, and so many of them are undermined even within the mental health system or by doctors. And a lot of people who struggle with eating disorders are a healthy weight, or maybe even overweight. Or I think that the thing you can do with friends and family, other than watching out for the obvious alarm bell signs, is just make sure they feel internally like properly supported and comfortable in terms of support networks for everything. And that means that when something like that starts to happen, when that starts to fall down, then they won't feel that it's something they need to hide, because eating disorders are really, really private things. They're really secretive. They're really lonely. And kind of a part of it is shutting it off from and hiding it from everyone. Like it's kind of your secret, like it's your thing. It's very important to know that people have that understanding that those kind of things exist, and that it's not always about the weight loss. If you are someone who struggles with an eating disorder, but you're maybe not clinically underweight, then the idea of coming out to people about it and saying, I struggle with food, can be the most daunting thing.
So in terms of what was mentioned in that segment of the interview, I mean, a quote there, it's really secretive and they're really lonely.
Yeah.
Surely that just amplifies how important it is that awareness is is brought up. And
yeah, definitely. But I think that that also highlights the thing that no matter how much awareness there is, there's always going to be a very secretive aspect about it. You do just always have to kind of like notice the warning signs and be aware to bring it up to someone.
It is one of the most difficult debates, is if you see somebody that you know but you aren't close to.
Yeah.
And if you think, well, is anything being done? Do you take that initiative? Do you take their mental health into your hands? Do you do something about it if you don't know them well?
I mean, I talk about this a bit more in my interview with Tom, and what he says, and I think it is important to kind of like draw on sufferers' perspectives about this because they will have had people coming up to them. I think one of the main things that came up in that interview was that you should approach them. But I think the really important thing is not to do it in a confrontation way, or, you know, get angry or say, I know you're doing this, because that is just far too pushy. A way better way of phrasing it would be, you know, like, I've noticed that you might be a bit uncomfortable around food and you seem to be quite anxious a lot of the time and you seem quite sad. So I just wanted to say that if you ever did have a problem, then I am here.
And I think that we'll be hearing from Hannah, our second interview, and I think that she discusses this issue in more depth about how to handle it when you notice it in somebody else. And I think that the thing that really comes out throughout all of these interviews is that it is just so individualistic, from people responding to therapy, help, talking with other people. Each individual experience is going to be different, and I think probably the emphasis should be on that one experience is no less valid than another. It's just a different one. And Rachel says that it's an invisible illness. The range of eating disorders is extraordinary, and so many of them are undermined even within the mental health system.
Yeah,
that really shocked me. I mean, that appalled me. How did you respond to that comment?
Just very quickly going back to what you said before, I think it's important to take into account, you know, when you hear these shocking statistics about eating disorders, about how many there are, it is important to think, okay, there are lots, but all of them are different, and so everyone is going to respond in a different way. And so I think it's quite easy to think like, oh, you know, I know about this, or I've suffered from this eating disorder, so I automatically know about someone else's eating disorder, when that isn't the case.
So now joined in the studio by two Jesses, just to make my life a little bit easier in terms of remembering names. So Jess Reed is now here, the president of Mind Matters Society, is that correct?
Yeah.
So do you want to quickly introduce what Mind Matters is, why it's so important, why is it part of our university union?
Okay, so Mind Matters, we are a mental health society. We have two strands. We support students who are experiencing mental health problems, and we also run campaigns. We go in and talk to young people about mental health. We run fundraisers, we run socials, so we're also a very campaigning, educational hub in the union, as well as being deliverers of welfare support.
So I would assume it hasn't at all escaped your notice as part of that society about the articles that Jess and I, other Jess and I, were discussing earlier about costumes in relation to Halloween and mental health patients. So one of the articles, this is from BuzzFeed, it was inspired by Jessie Davin, who is a 26-year-old from America, and she's written a post basically in protest against the anorexia costume that has been available to buy on the internet since 2011.
Wait, is it still available to buy?
I believe so. Jess, it's 2015 now. What's your reaction to this kind of idea?
It's just ridiculous and irresponsible. I just don't think there's any way of sugarcoating it and finding any other way. There's no way I can find in my brain of trying to justify why anyone would think it's a good idea. I don't understand why Halloween has turned into this thing where the idea is just to shock, because that's what it seems to have become, and doing this is incredibly harmful, and it's just so illogical. I just don't understand why you would want to go dressed as someone suffering from an eating disorder or whatever it might be. It just doesn't make any sense.
It is a baffling concept, of considering that thing of who would potentially wake up of a morning and think, what should I be for Halloween this year? And then that is what they find on the internet and find to be an appropriate choice. And the fact that it's being manufactured widespread, this isn't someone that's made that costume in their home one time.
Yeah.
this is a thing that's being sold on the internet. Do you think that shows, I suppose, a general lack of understanding and just awareness of the whole issue in general?
I mean, I think it can be a bit of both. I mean, obviously, I don't know the internet. I don't know who made this costume or what their motivations were. But I do think some people actually do legitimately don't understand, which actually highlights why it's so important to be talking about mental health, why it's so important to be talking about eating disorders and educating people, because if we don't, then this is the kind of thing we can just expect to keep seeing, because if people don't understand why it's wrong, then it's just, there's no reason for it to stop. The people who tend to go look at it and go, this is wrong, tend to be people who are educated in these things or who've gone through something similar or know someone who have.
I think it is very indicative about the lack of awareness around mental health as a whole. You know, I went into Rebs in Manchester and I was just getting something to eat, and the woman really casually went like, oh, do you want our normal sauce or our suicide sauce? I genuinely thought I'd misheard it.
There's a lot of that. I mean, shots, drinks in bars you can get are very, very often termed suicide.
Yeah.
And drinking games have suicide rounds. You know, that's not uncommon. And I think it perhaps like a few years ago, slightly better, not completely gone, but a few years ago, it was very common you'd hear the word gay used as an insult.
Yeah.
You know, that was hugely used. And I feel like maybe the mental health terms are the next wave, hopefully, to be abolished. It just doesn't seem to be happening.
I think it is. I think it is really encouraging when you look at it from the perspective of it is the younger generation who is bringing about these changes.
Yeah.
You know, the younger generation has realised that it's not appropriate to use the word gay, or it's not appropriate to say rape jokes or something like that, because it's just not funny. And I do agree with. I think. We are definitely moving towards a place where there will be a more open discussion. That doesn't necessarily mean that there will be less mental illness, but it does mean that treatment will be more accessible, and that hopefully recovery will be a little bit more possible. A huge portion of society is kind of excluded from the discussion around mental health, but I think to kind of combat that, what you can do is, you know, just in a casual way, when you're in a group of friends, like maybe there's a lull in the conversation, be like, I saw this article online about mental illness. What do you guys think? Just to bring it up and just bring it up into people's minds.
I mean, Jess, you're nodding there. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, definitely. I think a big part of the problem as well is that, especially with sort of terms like using the word mental, or sort of people will say, oh, I'm having the worst day, I just want to die, or like, you know what I mean? It becomes so ingrained in everyday language, and I think people just genuinely don't quite appreciate what they're saying and the effect that can have on people around them, and what sort of stereotypes and belief systems they are perpetuating.
Absolutely. Next we've got our interview with Hannah, so I'll play the first two parts together, otherwise I am every week really worried that we're going to run out of time to fully explore the issue and do it the justice that we can. So this is Hannah Coombe's story.
I first sort of noticed, like, or was starting to became conscious of, like, my body and sort of, you know, feeling down and stuff when I was about 13-ish. And then I tried to eat healthier, because there's a lot of, like, hype about eating healthy at the moment. It kind of got out of control. I started using food as a sort of coping mechanism for if I was feeling down or something. I just was like, okay, well, I won't eat. And then food stopped becoming something that I enjoyed, and instead became, like, a chore and something that I was, like, afraid of. So anyway, so then it kind of went downhill quite quickly, and I started skipping lunch at school and stuff. But then my friends noticed, and they told a teacher, and then the teacher told my parents. And then at first I denied everything, and then I said, oh no, they're just, like, misunderstanding. But then eventually I kind of admitted there was a problem, and I went to doctors. But the doctors originally turned me away and said it was just a phase, and that I should, you know, go away and come back in a month if there were still issues. So a month later, there were still issues, unsurprisingly. They referred me to an eating disorder unit, which is CAMS, Children's Adolescent Mental Health Services. But the waiting list for that was a month, so by this time, like, things were kind of getting worse. When I got there, you know, I had my assessment and stuff, and they told me I had anorexia. It was a bit of a shock, because I knew there were issues, but it's something you don't think is going to happen to you. It's kind of like a terrifying word. I'm not that sort of person, because I thought I was a sort of, like, type of person, which is ridiculous, but that's what, you know, no one knows much about it, so that's what I thought. We began the first steps to recovery, but it didn't go great at first, because there wasn't much support. I had weekly meetings, but in these meetings they would literally be like, how are you? And I'd say, oh, I'm all right. I'm like, okay. And then they'd be like, are you eating enough? I'd be like, yeah. And that was like literally it. So I wasn't very open. So eventually I got admitted inpatient to a priority eating disorders unit. And I made a lot of progress there and it helped me so, so much. And I was there for quite a long time. I was inpatient for maybe like 5 months and then day patient for like another five. But I only came in once a week towards the end. Then I got referred back to CAMHS and, you know, things are going much better. I was weight restored. I had a blip and I lost a bit, but got back on track after a few months and I'm now weight restored again. I'm doing a lot better and I can sort of see a future without an eating disorder and don't think it's something I need anymore. And like, I can logically think about it now, whereas when I was ill, you kind of lose all sight of what's normal and you don't really think you're going to get out of it. So it's good to be in a better mindset now.
You are fully recovered now. Is that how you would describe yourself?
Well, I think that's a difficult one because I guess eating disorders take a long time to get better from. Yeah. And although I am much better than I was and my weight is restored and I'm back to normal with that, I think it's something that I guess it's quite brave to classify yourself as fully recovered. Like, I wouldn't want to do that for a while, I guess, because there's always a chance of coming back, especially in stressful times such as like exams. So I guess I'm doing much better, but I think I've still got a bit of way to go.
Do you think that in your journey there was one definitive turning point?
It's more for me, it was looking back on things. Like, I sometimes, you know, you feel like nothing's changed. But then actually when I kind of look back at where I was and where I am now, I can see that there's a huge difference in the way I think and the way I behave. And but then there were like a few turning point moments, I guess, which was almost just like normal teenage things, like going to a party and enjoying yourself and like, you know, eating food and like watching a film with your friends with like sweets and chocolate and stuff. And kind of like silly small things like that that made me realise like that's what I want to be doing. I don't want to having to worry about things, but just enjoying life as it should be. I think it's just like small things like that made me realise that I wanted to get better.
You've also managed to really achieve incredible things where Enterprise is concerned.
So I guess I spent a lot of time inpatient with other girls and boys with eating disorders and also other mental health issues. So I kind of understood a lot of what they were going through because I have similar things for myself. But I found that there wasn't anything or much you could like buy to support or aid your recovery. Like, there isn't really, you know, something out there that you could have that, you know, makes you feel, you know, that bit better about recovery. So I thought, as a positive thing to come from obviously like negative as mental health issues, was to start a business where I could sell something to help people recover. So my first thing I started doing was hand stamping positive messages on spoons. So I did some set phrases and also people could personalize it. So I've had things like calories don't count on a spoon and take life one spoon at a time and keep going and or things like that, which actually was a huge success. And lots of my friends from inpatient recommended it to their friends, and people have contacted me back when they've received their spoon and said how helpful it's been, which really meant a lot to me, because I hate to think that these people go through these experiences without any support. So having just like a small impact like really means a lot to me. And recently I started doing recovery bugs, which are essentially, they're like semi-precious stones with goggly eyes that are like little bug things that are supposed to remind you to keep going, so you can have it in your pocket or wherever you are and just like something to like hold on to sort of like remind you to keep fighting. I explain more about the mission on my webpage, which is headofrecovery.weebly.com, if anyone wants to have a look.
I think that's really interesting, that one in particular. It's not specific to eating disorders really, is it?
I think people mistakenly think about mental health is that they're like separate things and that label is just that thing, but they're often like intertwined. So for example, I also suffer with anxiety and depression, but I mean, I'm getting better from all of them, but it's all interlinked, so it can stem from one thing or often just, I don't know, occur. And so I think having something that like helps all of them, like you don't have to have a specific, like an eating disorder or like one diagnosis, but any like helps anything. And I thought that would be something that people would find helpful.
This is Loose Think Tank. We're talking about eating disorders in young people. Again, it's the idea there coming out about the range of different disorders that maybe people are unaware of. And specifically Jess, so you're also a welfare rep at Leeds University Union. What services are there available at our university for someone that might be struggling or for somebody who notices it in someone else potentially?
So the university does actually have quite a lot of things going on. Some of them are university, some of them are union. Within the union itself, different societies offer different services. So for example, Mind Matters offer a general mental health support group every Tuesday from 5:30 till 6:30. Student Minds, who have merged with Mind Matters, offer an eating disorder specific support group every Monday from 6 p.m. till 7 p.m. in room 1 of the union. These are both groups where people can just come along. They don't have to talk. If they want to, then that's equally fine, and just get some support. Also, all Brilliant. The people running it are trained in what the services around Leeds are, so they can tell,
refer elsewhere as well. Brilliant. We're going to just hear the last section of the interview with Hannah to finish off our show, and then be the wider premises of recovery and how you've turned your experiences into a positive thing with your businesses. In terms of other responses, how do you think that the generation above us, so people that are currently, for example, health specialists, teachers, parents, how do you think they respond?
Personally, I found there's quite a lack of understanding with sort of most, you know, of a generation above us. So, for example, well, like my parents, when I first got diagnosed, like really didn't understand at all. But luckily, like through, they've done parent groups and things like that. And also both my parents have read into it on the internet and books as well. Like they now are really understanding. But it did definitely take a while. They weren't trying to be judgmental, they just didn't get it. And teachers, I think they're almost afraid of it. They try and avoid the fact that it's happening, and that's the same with parents as well. So they try and deny any issues because it's too difficult, too scary, or things like that. I don't think teachers are trained properly on how they should respond to it. I don't think they quite know what to do. Health professionals, I think it's a big mix, actually, because I've seen some really amazing, helpful people, but equally I've also seen some people who just don't understand at all and say completely the wrong things. So I think it possibly is getting better as like training gets better and understanding improves, but it does depend so much on who you see. So one person could see a therapist who's like amazing and understands them, but then someone might just be unlucky and have someone unhelpful. And I think it will affect how you progress through recovery if you have someone helpful by you, or if people understand.
Well, if somebody sees, you gave the example of a therapist who helps them a lot.
Some therapists might say like cheesy quotes or whatever, or something like that, or have I don't know, like more philosophical view. And sometimes I know people who just hate that sort of thing and think it's really stupid and like airy fairy. Yeah. Whereas actually I find those sorts of things quite inspiring. So like, for instance, that could, one person could find that really helpful and someone could be like, oh, they're just talking a load of rubbish. So it kind of depends. And some therapists and things just like click with people more, I guess. Like, just like anyone in life, you're going to meet people you like and people you don't like. And that's the same in a therapy relationship as well. Sometimes you'll just click with someone and get on with them better than other people. And that isn't necessarily anything to do with their skills or assets. Yeah. It's just how people respond to others.
The numbers of cases of mental health diagnoses from a whole range of mental illnesses, they are rising. So do you think schools, it's a job of a school to be better informed?
Yes, I definitely do. I think if teachers and staff were better aware of mental illnesses and knew, had more skills, then I think it would just help so much, because if you, you know, like, catch someone who's starting to fall into anorexia or the thought pattern, if you reach them and help them before they're critically underweight, that's going to be just so much easier for them to gain that weight back than if they're, you know, like 10 kilograms underweight. And it's not always about weight. So, like, with things like depression or like self-harm and things like that, the sooner someone speaks to them about it, it's just, it's going to speed up the whole recovery process. And if they're suffering in years of silence, they're going to get used to that way of being, so it's going to make it harder to go back to sort of a healthier mind. So I definitely think it is the responsibility of schools as a caring thing that they should be doing more. So things like PSHE, I think they should cover mental illnesses and body image and all that sort of stuff earlier, because if you were taught about that sort of stuff earlier, you'd be far more aware of not only yourself and how you're mentally doing, but your friends. So, for example, if your friends started to sort of become withdrawn and stuff, you might notice that and speak to a teacher, rather than if you didn't really know about it, you might just think, oh, she's in a, you know, bad mood, that's just her, whereas it might actually be something else.
If you notice a peer and you think they are potentially becoming unwell, for example, because of an eating disorder, what is the action that you would advise to take in that situation?
If they were a close friend, you might approach them about it and talk to them about it, which some people might, you know, be grateful that someone's talking to them about it. Some people might deny it. It completely depends on that individual person. But if it's someone you don't particularly know very well, they might find that intimidating. So I'd recommend sort of seeing a teacher or someone who maybe the like form tutor or, you know, whoever looks after that person, or someone you think that they'll trust or talk to more.
Are there any particular organisations, charities that you've had experiences with or that you'd recommend?
I've done a fundraiser for BEAT, which is a Beating Eating Disorders charity, because I think they're incredibly helpful, because they offer resources for people suffering with eating disorders and sort of help and things like that, but also families and parents and, you know, friends of people with eating disorders. They offer links to things like good therapy centres or therapists. And I just think they have the whole range of things you might need if you're struggling, which I think is really helpful to have it all in one place. Also, Mind is a charity which I think it's quite local, but they do mental health talks. We had one at our school, which I thought was really good to actually have someone talking about it in our school so that people were more aware of mental health. Yeah. And they fund research projects as well, so I think they're also a really good charity. But one more is Papyrus, which is a young suicide prevention charity, so I think that was a really good one as well, because again, I think people feel so desperate that they might resort to that, whereas if there was sort of someone they could talk to, I think, you know, it might change the outcome.
Any other comments or ideas or opinions that you'd like to voice on the general subject?
Firstly, don't be afraid to talk about your experiences if you have a mental health issue. It's not something to be ashamed of, or it's so common, actually, that it's just as common as physical illnesses, and it should be no different. And the more people start talking about it, then the more quickly things are going to change. So people will start understanding more. Other people might come forward about how they feel. Don't ever be ashamed to say that you've got a mental health issue. Is one big thing I think people should know. And that recovery is possible. I know a lot of people who think it's actually not possible, and they say, oh yeah, but it'll always be in the back of your mind. But I don't think that's true. I think if you believe that you can do it, and you just work really, really hard, and even when things go wrong, just maintain a sort of hope that things can get better, I 100% think that you can beat mental illnesses, and just like you can beat a physical illness, it's absolutely no different.
This has been Loose Think Tank, our special on eating disorders. Today we've we've learned, I suppose, that education services do need an improvement, and that's talked about a lot in Rachel's interview part three. Like I say, it'll be online, especially in terms of communication and potentially does our generation, I suppose, need to lead the battle in change and awareness on this issue. And as Hannah put it earlier, it's all about the fact that if it stays in the shadows and no one talks about it, nothing's going to change. So any closing comments from either Jess?
I think it was really striking, the difference between Rachel and Hannah's interview, but I think it is really important to remember, if someone starts recovery, don't give up on it, because it is a long and painful process. But I think from Hannah's interview, it is clear that it's worth it.
I'd just say it one more time, as Hannah perfectly put it, if people don't talk about it, it's going to stay in the shadows and nothing's going to change. Jess Reed, president of Mind Matters, any closing comments at all?
All I'd say is, just if you're listening to this and you do feel like you have a problem, tell someone. It can be a helpline, someone you know, just tell someone, because yeah, it can completely change your life.
Get support, absolutely. This has been Lose Think Tank, our special on eating disorders in young people on Leeds Student Radio.
This is a podcast from Leeds Student Radio.